You lived your life like you want your life to be. Did you pass the blame, get lost on a runaway train?
Hello and welcome to the Privileged Man podcast. My name is Esben Baring and I'm your host. On this podcast, you're going to hear about the experiences of men and women who became aware of and found ways to break free from the molds of expectation, to live their lives adventurously and truthfully, and discover their true selves along the way. These sovereign souls are sharing the insights they had that led them to be unapologetically who they are. These conversations are rich with moments of realization, transformation, and insight that can inspire the willingness to look at your life in new and refreshing ways. My guest today is Jamie Smart. Jamie is a Sunday Times best-selling author, speaker, and coach, and he's passionate about sharing the principles behind clarity with individuals and organizations. He's worked with household name companies, including The Guardian newspaper and Hewlett-Packard. He's done keynote speeches to organizations as diverse as the NATO Defense College and the mental health charity Mind. Jamie is the author of the best-selling books, Clarity and Results. It's my great privilege and honor to welcome Jamie Smart, who has been my mentor and friend for the past 2 years of my life and been an instrumental part of my evolution and growth. And Jamie has been an expression of love, understanding, compassion, and patience in a time where I needed it most. So, Jamie, welcome to the podcast. It's lovely to see you.
Good to see you, Esben. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. So, I encountered you around November 2019, it was, so pre all the madness that was unfolding, at a time in my life where I was deeply struggling with myself and meandering in and out of dark and frightening places in my own mind. And I found you by, I guess I would call it grace, in the sense that your presence was made aware to me. And I started watching some videos of what you were speaking about on the internet, around an understanding of how the mind works, a relatively new paradigm for how the mind actually works. And nothing made more sense to me in that moment than to reach out to you and see if you and I could be in a conversation, which led to my becoming a mentee of yours, which has now been longer than 2 years. Jamie, I'd love to hear a little bit about your journey as a man, as a young man, how you started out, that led you up to the point of discovering the principles and how they've impacted your life.
Yeah, I will. And just to say, the last couple of years have been quite a journey. It's been quite a time. So yeah, good to be here with you, Esben. Good to still be here with you.
Yes, indeed.
So I was born in the UK, but my family emigrated to Canada when I was 2 years old, and I grew up in Canada. My dad was a chronic alcoholic, so I grew up in an alcoholic household, with my dad having that going on, and then my mom being effectively in a codependent relationship with an alcoholic. Mm-hmm. And I had no awareness of that particularly. You know, I had my mom and dad, other people had their mom and dad. There was no comparison of the mom and dads. You kind of got what you got. So interesting that when I look at the reasons we make the decisions we make. So when I was like 11 or 12 years old, my parents gave me the choice. They said that I was going to need to go to a private school, which is in Canada is the what they call in the UK a public school. So
right.
School, an independent school. And they gave me the choice that I could either go to a local school called Glen Lyon or a further away school called Shawnigan Lake School. And And my primary decision-making was made on the basis that if I went to Glen Lyon, I would have to wear a uniform to school every day. And if I went to Shawnigan Lake School, which was a boarding school, I wouldn't. And that was basically it. It's like, okay, I'm going away to boarding school. Now, here's the funny thing, though. I went away to boarding school when I was 12. I was very small as a child, by the way. And so I was bullied all the way through school and through boarding school and that sort of thing. And I found my own ways of dealing with that, of navigating that, of avoiding getting harmed and all that sort of stuff. When I was 12, I also discovered, because up until that point, up until I was 12, I was very stressed and anxious and worried child. And then I discovered something that just handled that, and it was alcohol. So I started drinking when I was 12, and I was like, oh yeah, this is it. This is great. This is just what I need. It's like, why didn't they give me this earlier? This is just the ticket. And so that became kind of my hobby for the next 18 years. It was like, I loved drinking. I got into all kinds of scrapes and problems and challenges, but that was, I mean, it just seemed like, somehow it seemed fine. And then I when I was 16, I came to the UK on a rowing tour, and I really liked the attitude towards drinking in the UK at the time. So this is like, I don't know, the late 80s. Because in Canada, my level of drinking was kind of frowned on, whereas in the UK it seemed to be fine. People, so I ended up relocating to the UK when I was 20, and I, you know, got a career here and all that sort of stuff. Became a project manager, running IT projects and that sort of thing. And the alcohol was kind of like rocket fuel for that. Like, I was able to do hard and scary things as long as I had a drink. In 1996, I got married, fell in love, and I got married. And within a few months, she was on the verge of leaving me. Like, I remember one night I'd been on a bender that night and been poured in the door. And she and I were due to go out that night, but I'd got waylaid at an afternoon, a garden party that ended up having me poured in the door at midnight. And she was like, I'm leaving. And that was maybe 3 months into the marriage. And so I said, I woke up the next morning. I said, her bags were packed. I said, baby, don't go. I'm going to stop drinking. So that seemed like a good idea. But within a short period of time, I was anxious, depressed, suicidal, all that stuff. Because I had thought that alcohol was my problem, but actually alcohol was medicine for a thinking problem, an emotional problem, an understanding problem. I had, you know, not through anyone's fault, I had grown up with a false understanding of who I was and what I was and wasn't capable of, and how my experience was created, and what my emotions meant, and all that sort of stuff. And when I found alcohol at 12, I found a way of mediating and medicating that set of misunderstandings that I'd grown up with, and medicating the emotional pain of that. And so it made sense to do it until it didn't, until my wife left me. So I stopped drinking, became miserable, depressed, suicidal. Ended up getting into recovery. Because the choices were either, you know, kill myself, start drinking again, or do something else. I got into recovery and I was like, well, this isn't going to work. But a certain period of time, maybe a month into recovery, I'm sitting there in a church hall in London, and it suddenly hit me. I'm like, oh, maybe even though I know that I'm different and that this couldn't work for me, maybe it could work anyway. Maybe there's something I've missed. Like, it's almost like, and I'm not claiming these as personal qualities, by the way, but it's almost like that afternoon as I kind of fell out of my preoccupations with myself and how I was doing and my life and all that sort of stuff, I got touched by kind of humility and hope and possibility. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, this could work for you. This could work for you. I was like, holy shit. I'd never known that. So long story short, within a few years of stopping drinking, actually within 18 months of getting into recovery, my head started to clear and I started growing up, basically, like not drinking from 12 till 32 or whatever age I was, 12 till 30 something. My emotional maturation had basically gone on hold. And so I had some growing up to do. But a couple of years into that, I was on a training course. And on this training course, so this is like 1998, I had a couple of insights. And it was kind of a personal development training course that I'd been on for my work. I was working as a consultant. Mm-hmm. And I got sent on this training course to improve my influence skills, like, because I was involved in big projects at the time. And the things that always screwed up projects were the people stuff, you know, hearts and minds, all that sort of stuff. So they said, go on this course so you can become more influential at helping people navigate change, you know, because that's what it was all about. And so I go on this course, and during this course, I had two insights. Now, I didn't know they were insights. But the first insight was, oh, you can do anything you want to. You can at least have a go at it. See, up until that point, Esmond, I'd experienced life as something that was happening to me. That it was like it was already laid out. It was like a game where the rules were already all established and the roles had been distributed and everything like that. And I was just there, like, doing my best to do my part and to obey the rules and all that sort of stuff. And I felt completely like these are the kind of words people use for it in my world these days, but I didn't have any of these words at the time. But I was like, I was at the effect of it. This was happening to me. This was coming at me. And I was just doing my best to get through. And that was very stressful. And so alcohol really helped with that. But now that I didn't have alcohol, I had to do something else. So I my first insight was, oh, you can do whatever you put your mind to, or you can at least have a go at it. Like, you're the co-creator of your life. I realized, Esmond, that I'd been responsible. I'd had an active role the whole time in creating the life I was living. I just hadn't known it. Genuinely hadn't known it. So I was like, whoa. The second insight I had was like, I want to do this stuff. So like this teacher was coming out and training us and telling stories and coaching people. And it was just like, I was like, I want to do this. But I had a problem, which was I was afraid of public speaking. Mm-hmm. I had no discernible skills in that or coaching or anything like that. But I kind of knew this is what I wanted to do. So I secured a contract, quit my job, became a contractor. That meant I would have more free time and more control over my hours and more income. Because I knew, oh, you need to invest in basically reskilling and retraining if you want to do it in a career. Yeah. So I did that. Did that literally, quit my job a couple of weeks later, did that, and spent the next few years just learning, going on courses, training, getting better as a coach, as a therapist, as an educator, as a public speaker, all that sort of stuff, learning that stuff. And I ended up growing my first business, a company called Salad, from which I did a couple of businesses. My very first one was a partnership with a guy where we were doing corporate coaching and consulting and team building and that sort of thing. And then beginning of 2003, I launched a company called Salad and built a educational products business, which was, and here's the funny thing. by 2008, I had this very successful business. But I wasn't feeling fulfilled. And I read this book by Tim Ferriss called The 4-Hour Work Week. And it was like, you know, I can't remember what the subtitle was, but it was like, get your life running on autopilot and join the new rich kind of thing. And I was like, that's what I need to do. The premise of the book was get your business working on 4 hours work a week, and then have mini retirements, go on adventures. And I thought, if I do that, then I'll be happy. So I spent a year. That was 2007, actually. Spent the next year getting the business to that point where I could do it, and went for my first mini retirement, which was a 3-month ski holiday to Whistler in Canada. So, like, as far as I was concerned, this was going to have it all. I was going to be skiing. My skiing was going to be getting better. I was going to be successful according to the rules of my industry. I was going to be having 3 months off. I'd made it. Like, I go out there, and after like 6 weeks, I was miserable and I was off purpose and I was depressed. And I was like, God, this isn't it either. What's missing? And so I went back to the drawing board. And in that process, I hired a coach. And in that process, I got introduced to the understanding that is now what I spend all my time working on with people. And I had three insights, and I'll take you quickly through them. And then that's kind of my story. My first insight was, oh, the fact that you can, it was, well, let me get it. Let me get really in touch with it. Yeah. My first insight was everything you've been looking for outside of you is already there within you. See, I'd been living life as though there was somewhere to get to, and there was better than here. And once I was there, I would be happy and peaceful and secure and joyful and loving. But my job for now was to get there. And the realization was, oh, everything you've been looking for outside of you is already there within you. You've already got it. Now, I'd read that and heard that, and, you know, people had told me that intellectually. But I'd never known it for myself, and suddenly I knew it insightfully. Now, as a side note, one of the things I've since discovered, Esmond, is that every single human being has an innate capacity for insight and realization.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, that was my second insight. My second insight was the fact that a person can even see or hear or feel or experience or perceive means they have this source of realization, insight, clarity, peace, resilience, and transformation already there within them. You know, I know you're in the process of creating a transformation program for men, and I know that you'll be leveraging that capacity that every man has within him. Like, that's what your expertise in bringing to the fore is gonna do for people. That was my second insight, was, wow, the fact that a person can even see or hear or feel or perceive means they have innate mental health, they have innate mental well-being, means there's nothing wrong with them. There's nothing wrong with you. I was like, whoa, well, that transformed my work immediately. You know, I was already coaching and teaching, but that changed everything. Third insight, in June of 2009, up until that point, I thought, well, this is very interesting. But I'd read literally hundreds of psychology books and personal development books. I'd studied all kinds of different psychological modalities. Up until that point, I was like, this is a very interesting methodology. It's worthy of your investigation. And but when people talked about this as pointing to pre-existing truths, pre-existing facts, I was like, don't give me that. It's just beliefs. This is an interesting belief system, interesting methodology, but it ain't the be all and end all. And in June 2009, in a sudden insight, I was like, oh, this is principles. This understanding is to psychology what the discovery of germs was to medicine. You know, the discovery of germs resulted in massive increase in human lifespan and survival of, you know, operations that used to kill people and all kinds of stuff. Like, it contributed to a tenfold increase in the standard of living for human beings and a significant extension in lifespan. And the discovery that the psychological equivalent of the discovery of germs. I was like, oh, this is huge. Literally that day, I called up my office and said, we're changing direction. There's principles for psychology. And that's what I've been doing ever since. So that's been my work for the last 13 years that led to me releasing the book Clarity and the Sunday Times bestseller Results and to all the training programs I do and everything. And that's the journey I've been on.
Thank you, Jamie.
That was a long answer.
Well, it was, and it was lovely in the way it flowed. And you know, as I'm here with you, listening to you speak, I'm reminded of that familiar feeling of connection that you and I have when we're together in conversation, and the stillness of this conversation is as you're sharing of yourself and what you've seen. And as you shared around the distorted mind that you inherited from your family upbringing and how you then medicated that with alcohol and for all intents and purposes stunted your growth as an individual. As I've been in conversation with you over the last 2 years, it is that slowing down and that stillness that we discover together that can create a fertile breeding ground for our capacity for insight to emerge. And that's something that I would like to, you know, highlight and impress upon anyone who's listening to our conversation, is that there is nothing to do. And every time that we're going to look for an answer, we're further and further away from the truth of who we are. And you outlined it and articulated it beautifully in your two books, Clarity and Results, around contaminated thinking, a contaminated mind. And that's all it is. And just to slow us down and bring us back to this moment of connection, this idea of Esmond with this idea of Jamie together, there is that potential for us to drop into that feeling.
And I'd love to speak to that, because it's funny, Esmond, you know, while it's enjoyable and pleasant and beautiful to hang out in that feeling, which I'll describe a little more in a second, it also looks incredibly leveraged. Like, it looks to me like the reason why I endeavor to find my way into that feeling space with my clients, whether it's a one-on-one client or a group of clients, is because it's what I describe as an insight-friendly space. That's the kind of place where people often have profound insights into the nature of their being and what matters to them and all that sort of stuff. And the way I talk about it now, which I didn't express it like this in either of my books, but over the last few years, it's become clearer and clearer to me, is that I believe that the two most valuable things a person can discover are how their experience is created moment to moment and who they really are. Now, how their experience is created moment to moment, the reason that's so valuable is because we're living in our experience. Like, we're living in our experience moment to moment, and the blessings and the curses, the highs and the lows, the ups and the downs, they're all happening in our moment-to-moment experience. So understanding how that experience is created is incredibly valuable for people. So I find that a really useful place to start with people. But the second thing, which I think is probably even more valuable, is to discover who you really are. You know, there's a quote by Teilhard de Chardin, which I paraphrase and kind of butcher. I do an updated version of it. I hubristically do an updated version of it. He said, we're not human beings having spiritual experience. We're spiritual beings having a human experience. I always liked that. But how I put it now is, we're not human beings having a spiritual experience. We are one spiritual being having 7 billion human experiences. And who you really are is that one spiritual being. Who you really are is consciousness itself. And it seems a strange thing to say that I believe that one of the most valuable things a person can discover is who they really are. But the reason is quite simple. You know, when we identify with the roles that we've been given, whether it's, you know, head boy or father or son or boss or banker or employee or husband or father or entrepreneur, whatever role we may have been handed, when we identify with our personality as well, you know, I am tall, I am short, I am stupid, I am clever, I am top of the class, I am bottom of the class, I am lazy, I am driven, all those I ams, we're overlooking the truth of our being and the truth of who we really are. And all of those things that I just listed, they're all impermanent, you know? Businesses and factories and companies are impermanent. Houses and homes and economies are impermanent. Mountains and planets are impermanent. But who you really are is timeless and eternal. Mm. It can't be harmed or damaged by anything in this world of stuff. Your leg can, right? Definitely. You can definitely get a twisted ankle in the world of stuff. But who you really are can't be damaged. And there's something, Esmond, that, you know, one of my graduates, Mahima Shrestha, she had started looking in this direction, stuff I'm talking about, and she was caught in the Nepal earthquake of 2015. And so, you know, that was a huge earthquake, knocked buildings down, killed thousands of people. And so she's sitting there, terrified in the aftershocks of that earthquake, like literally every few minutes it's happening again, right? It's a terrifying situation. And then it suddenly occurs to her, if I'm actually living in the experience of thought in the moment, if I'm living in my moment-to-moment experience, then I'm as safe as I've ever been. And she woke up. She had an insight into the truth of her being, and she realized that she was psychologically safe. And she said it just settled her right down. And I was interviewing her about it at my clarity certification training. I was interviewing her about this experience. And she made this comment that she suddenly realized that she was safe as she had ever been, that she was psychologically safe. And we were taking questions from the audience, and someone asked, well, how did you know you were safe? Like, you're in the middle of an earthquake. How did you know you were safe? She said, well, if you mean physically safe, I didn't know that. Like, I wasn't. I mean, how do you know you're physically safe now? The roof could cave in this building. Like, yeah, I didn't know that. She said, but I knew I was, who I was safe, that I was psychologically safe, that the truth of my being couldn't be harmed. And it may sound to someone who's listening just like words, but what I can promise you is that there is a there. There's a who you really are that you can experience and that you can wake up to the truth of, and you have the innate capacity to do so. And as you do, it creates enormous freedom. Like there's huge value in knowing who you are, and there's also huge value in knowing who you're not.
Right.
You know, you're not your job title. You're not your bank balance. You're not other people's expectations of you. And we can know that intellectually. We can read it in a book, but to experience it viscerally is a game changer for people. So these days, Esmond, I see my job, if you like, and this is going to sound very metaphorical and poetic, but I see my job as being like to hold up a mirror that reflects someone's true being back at them. That's my job. I just want to, and these words and that silence and peace and connection we talked of, the purpose of that is to hold up a mirror that allows someone to fall awake to the truth of their being. It allows them to catch a glimpse of who they really are. Because that's the source of everything that everyone wants.
And my experience of being in that reflection of the mirror that you've been holding up has been, for a moment, almost to fall out of thought and to realize and to see that it was thought that I was experiencing and mistakenly believing to be who I am. And relief is a word that I would perhaps use most about many of the conversations we've had when I've come in a frenetic or panicked or emotional state, is that within a few short moments of you reminding me of that, how easy it is for me to fall out of the mistaken identification with that experience that has been running through consciousness, just to drop back into safety and peace. And it reminds me of when you and I first started working together, which is back in March 2020, and you and I had scheduled a three-day intensive up with you in Nottingham, is that right?
Yeah.
And I was really, really excited about this. I was going to have 3 days with Jamie Smart, deepening my understanding into these three principles, so that in my mind, I was telling myself I was going to come away with the solution to all my woes. And this was around the 16th of March, it was. And I think we were scheduled the 26th or 27th of March. And the shit started hitting the fan with the pandemic. And I had this little whispering from inside of me. Well, maybe I should go back to Bali now. Maybe I should get on a plane. If I don't get on a plane from London to Bali, maybe it'll shut and I'll be separated from my daughter for an unknown quantity of time. And I jumped on the phone with you and you asked me a simple question as I was panicking about what I should or shouldn't do. And you said, Esmond, if you knew you were going to be okay no matter what would you do? And the answer immediately emerged from within, from which I can only now articulate as wisdom speaking to me, was to change my flight and get on a plane that evening, which I did. And I landed into Bali the next day, which was my birthday. And the borders closed the following day. And if I hadn't asked that question or answered that, if I hadn't asked you the question, if you hadn't asked me a question and I'd listened to the response that came, I would have been separated from my daughter for 9 months. And my whole life would have taken a completely different direction. So a choice emerged by asking you the question and you reflecting back to me another question. A choice emerged with which I responded to. And what I loved about what you were sharing earlier about the first and the second insight you had, where it seemed as though life was happening all around you and at you, it can almost feel like there is no choice. But from the viewpoint that you're looking through, it seems so true that that's the way experience is. And for me, the ability to understand that I'm available to insight in any moment provides me with new choices and new ways to look. So for all intents and purposes, I come out of the idea that I am a victim to life and what's happening around me, and I become the creative source to choose a new direction, and it brings in possibility. So what I'd never ever seen before was possibility, and now possibility is a part of my life.
Yeah, that's beautiful, and I think I imagine a lot of people, at least in some aspect of life, can relate to what you're just saying about it seeming like you don't have choice. I have to do this. I have to do this job because I have to pay that mortgage, because I have to meet these responsibilities, because I have to do this, I have to do that. And undoubtedly, there are some aspects of your life which, if you were to really reflect deeply on it and come to it with a deep sense of security and well-being, there may well still be things which are non-negotiable. And that's fine. I respect that. But what I often find when I'm working with clients, I work with people who are running very, very large enterprises and that sort of thing, but feeling kind of trapped or imprisoned by the organization they're at the helm of. That as people fall out of their basically feelings of insecurity, you know, so we can dress them up with more male-friendly words like anger or frustration, but whether it's anger and frustration, or whether it's anxiety, stress and worry, or whether it's depression or urgency or whatever, there are examples of basically kind of just our ego on patrol, right. And this people kind of. One of the reasons I do 3-day intensives is I want to create the time and space for people to really fall out of their ideas about themselves and their world and all that stuff and wake up to a source of wisdom and intelligence and guidance and transformations that's there within them. Like it's there within everyone. And even I often have clients who say, yeah, I don't think I have that. And I'm like, yeah, you do. Like it's so, I can see it written all over them in so many ways that they have that capacity. So the result of that, you know, that second insight I mentioned, the fact that a person can even see, hear, perceive, feel anything, means they have that source of clarity, resilience, realization, and transformation already there within them. I saw that back in 2009, I glimpsed the truth of it, and it immediately made me more hopeful for my clients and for myself, for that matter. But what's happened over the past 13 years is I've put that to the test again and again and again, and every time it comes up trumps. So I now have not only the realization of that, but a huge degree of conviction in it, which results in a huge degree of hopefulness. Like I know that's the place to look. Like I don't even bother looking anywhere else. I look there. I look to that source of, and that's why when you ask me that question around, you know, what should I do? Should I stay or should I go? As The Clash once famously said, I didn't know what you should do, right? Like I had no idea. It's like, it was clear to me that it was a really important decision for you, and that it was a decision that if I told you what I thought you should do or tried to counsel you or anything, there was a strong degree that whatever you did, you'd be left with regret over having not done the other one, right? Like they both had, you know, it was not an easy decision at the level of the personality. And so I knew that if you were to find a way for that wisdom within to guide you, that you'd know exactly what to do. And it would be at least relatively free from regrets. I say relatively because anyone's regret level is going to just be a function of what they're thinking at the time. But so that's why I asked the question, you know, what would you do if you absolutely knew that you're going to be okay no matter what? You know, it's funny, Esmen, my beloved is currently working on a program for young people in schools. She starts next week, so she's going in and working with sixth formers who are beset with worry and anxiety and chronic stress about doing exams. They've been locked down for a couple of years. They've never done exams, and now they're freaking out. And I asked her, what's the number one, like if you could wave a magic wand and have these people realize anything, like they could have any realization you want, what would you love them to see for themselves? She thought about it, and she said, I'd love them to see you're going to be okay no matter what. No matter how you do in your exams, no matter how your job's going, you're going to be okay no matter what. And it's paradoxical, Esmond, because the moment someone realizes that, they immediately become more sovereign in their life. They become more able to take calculated risks, more loving, more willing to play full out in the richness and beauty of life. So it's ironic. The more we think the more fear we have about how things have to be in order for us to be okay, the more messed up our navigation becomes. And the more we realize the truth of who we are and what we've got going for us and what can and can't hurt us,
yeah,
the more freedom we have to be ourselves.
100%. 100%. And I reflect back on some of the journey that we've been on together, as I guess I've learned to articulate who I am and be willing to feel everything associated with that. I'm reminded of that quote by Sydney Banks, which was, if people learn just one thing, which is to not be afraid of their experience, then the whole world would change. And it's really, really stayed with me. Mm-hmm. As I came to realize that I drank alcohol or took drugs or became a serial relationship man, jumping from partner to partner, was in some way to avoid feeling my feelings. And I remember saying to you, like, starting to, you know, record videos and speak my voice, and I'm worried about what people are going to think, whether people are going to like me, and coming back with the truth of, well, speaking up and going into the arena of life about anything, people are not going to like you. People are going to judge you. People are going to criticize you. So just accept that. And I howled with laughter.
Yeah, they're probably judging you right now. Me too.
Of course. And now, how brilliant that is. And I realized that I think the willingness to be with the fullness of the experience of life has changed my life, because I'm no longer avoiding life. I'm with the fullness of that experience. And you mentioned earlier about public speaking. And I remember listening to one of the talks that you gave when you were standing up, I don't know, in front of 150 men or 200 men to speak about sexuality and relationship, I think it was. And at the beginning of the talk, you know, I was looking at you and I was modeling and trying to understand what it was that you were coming up in your experience before you got ready to give the talk. And I could feel this sense of, let's say, anticipation or nervousness or fear that may have arisen in your voice. And I asked you about that. And, you know, even in that moment, to be cognizant and reminded that we're only ever experiencing the feeling of thought taking form in the moment. So there's fearful thinking that has arisen, and it'll pass if I acknowledge it and be with it and don't resist it and go down the idea that I'm going to fall on my feet and have nothing to say, because that's what may end up being created. So, you know, one of the hugest takeaways from our time together and the work that I've been doing is my willingness to feel everything that comes through me and realize that it comes and it goes and it ebbs and it flows and it passes. And none of it is who I am. And my feelings, of course, they're not going to kill me. So when Sydney Banks says those words, if human beings learn just one thing, which is to not be afraid of their experience, then the whole world will change, it's become true for me. It's really, truly, deeply become true for me. And you've encouraged me and goaded me and pushed me and nudged me and screamed at me at times that life is a practice, in the sense that whenever we try anything new, we're right at the edge of the unknown. And we have no idea what life is going to push back and give us unless we're prepared to go and stick our head in and have a good look around. And I think it's really interesting, because I've realized that finally. So here I am in this conversation with you, and my life feels alive, perhaps for the first time ever, without some kind of external substance to support me along the way. And I'm hugely grateful for that. And I have no idea what's coming next, but I'm open to that experience and I'm welcoming it in to see what comes. And that's really been utterly transformational and amazing for my life. So I'm very grateful to you for that.
It's lovely to hear that when you said, you know, that you're having the experience of being fully alive for the first time. I love that. Like, I love that. And my own experience kind of mirrors yours. And for me, it's kind of been like peeling an onion. Like, there's still, I still get captured by, you know, the idea that, oh, this needs to work a certain way, or it's not going to be, or I can't let go of that because blah, blah, blah. But as I look again in this direction, it's just falling away, falling away, falling away, and creating more and more freedom and more impact and more love and joy. You know, I often say I experience more love and connection in the average day than I used to in the average year.
Yeah, same. Same. I remember being a 27-year-old man and working in a corporate role where I felt driven to make money in order to secure some sense of security, happiness, and choice in life. Because I really felt as though that the only way for me to have real choice in life would be to have enough money to do things. And I realized that actually in the making of more money, yeah, some other choices became available to me. But I was still trapped in the ice tray. And I remember the story of when I capitulated and I made a demand. I said, what the fuck am I doing with my life? There has to be more to this, more to life than this. And I think that in a way opened me up to new possibility. And yeah, I mean, I think I've spoken to it myself in what I've shared. It became too much. The mold that I'd found myself in was too painful, and something had to break and give. And that is what happened. So I guess my question to you is do you have any examples of people you've worked with who've experienced something similar and any insights that they've had along the way to see something new?
What you're really describing, I think, is that on the one hand, people, you know, and certainly in Western society, we've got a certain model for life that a lot of people go on. And there are advantages to that. Like, geez, there are advantages to having a decent IQ. Like, there are huge advantages. And there are advantages to having a good education. And there are advantages to having money. Like, those are all things. But there's a concept called hedonic adjustment, which is that we live in a world where we're told the idea that the more money we have, the more visible success we have, and the more fame or celebrity we have, the happier, the more peaceful, more joyful, the more well-being, the more love we're going to experience. Clearly, that's not the case. All you need to do is go and spend some time with, you know, the senior partners in a law firm, or look at the very mixed quality of life that lottery winners experience,
right?
Or even the mixed. This is a sad one. You know, Olympic gold medal winners, typically after they win their Olympic gold medal, there's a very sharp divergence in how their life plays out after that. About 50% of them go on to experience really fulfilling, happy lives, creating companies, doing charity work, training and coaching others, being speakers, doing like, and are very fulfilled and happy doing it. The other 50% typically fall into mental health challenges, addiction, depression, that sort of thing. And it's because the ones who fall into mental health challenges, drug addiction, that sort of thing, they've been doing an I'll be happy when. Being going, I'll be happy when, you know, I win the varsity championship. I've won the varsity championship. Oh, still not happy. I guess I need to win the nationals. It's like, I'll be happy when I win the nationals. I've won the nationals. Oh, I'm not happy. Oh, okay, I got it. I guess I've got to make the Olympic team. I'll be happy once I make the Olympic team. I've made the Olympic team. Oh, still not happy. I guess I got to get the gold medal. They win the gold medal. Still not happy. And now they've run out of road.
Right.
And is based on a fundamental misunderstanding of where happiness, well-being, successfulness comes from. Now, that's not just endemic in our society. It's also endemic in our neurology in a way. It's endemic in having an ego. Like the notion that there's somewhere to get to and there is better than here. Like, there's a kernel of truth in it. There's always room to, you know, improve our circumstances or create new things or that sort of thing. But the idea that happiness, well-being, security, love flow from that? No, they come from within. You know, I just a side note, I watched a excellent series called Dope Sick, which is a dramatization of the devastating impact of the drug OxyContin on the U.S. particularly, and the fraudulent behavior of the Sackler family and many other, the owners of Purdue Pharma, who profited massively from that. But the Sackler family, who were, you know, experiencing enormous levels of wealth, power, and so on, were portrayed, and I assume somewhat accurately, as a miserable, unhappy, emotionally frozen group of people. And I don't think that was just poetic license. I assume that's relatively well portrayed. And the fact is that we live in a society where we're presented a bill of goods as this is the, basically we're given a model of this is the way to a life of happiness and well-being and peace and joy and love and all of that, success, esteem, fulfillment. But unfortunately, it's a broken model. And it's a game that doesn't end. And so almost everyone I work with, when I first start working with them, they're stuck. So the word I have for that frustration you described is they're stuck. They've either reached as high as they can go within the current model, and it's still not delivering the promised benefits, you know, happiness, well-being, security, peace of mind, fulfillment. Or they've just kind of lost enthusiasm for the current model. It's like there must be something else. And so the thing that always, you know, the only thing I know that's going to help someone is the insights and realizations they have from within themselves. And so I work with them to create, because it's interesting. I was working with a chap, and his ambition was to build a massive global organization. He already had what was for me a massive global organization, like generating, you know, huge amounts of income and employing, you know, thousands of people around the world. But he wanted to take it to a Amazon, Tesla level. And so I asked them the questions I always ask clients, which is, what would that give you that you wouldn't otherwise have? And he told me, and then I took that and I asked him, what would that give you? And where we got to after I'd asked that question six or seven times is he said something to the effect of, I get to the end of my life and I'd know that I'd lived a good life and I'd have a sense of peace and purpose and well-being when I reach the end of my life. And I said, okay, well, I'm going to tell you something. And based on what I tell you, you're going to know either that I'm a great coach for you or I'm a terrible coach for you. It'll be one or the other. He goes, oh, I'm intrigued. I said, well, if you and me work together, the first thing we're going to do is we're going to get together for 3 days. And then that thing you described about of having at the end of your life, you're going to start experiencing that now. You're going to realize that sense of peace and well-being and security and joy and love. You're going to start experiencing it now and more. I said, and from that place, knowing that you already have it, you may be inspired to create a massive global company, or you may be inspired to sell your company and travel the world with your family. Like, I don't know what's going to make sense to you once you realize you've already got everything you've been looking for. But what I see, Esmond, is once people realize they already have it, it unlocks their creativity and their expression. Mm-hmm. And so people often become more entrepreneurial, and the funny thing is they often walk away from the stuff they felt driven to create and create something that's even more, you know, inspiring. Purposeful, all that sort of stuff. So that often when people first start working with me, they're in that place of frustration and stuck because they've reached an impasse, working from within their current paradigm, living from within their current psychological paradigm. They've reached the edge of their current model.
I love that. And as you're speaking, I think, you know, an insight is, it's almost like a shift of viewpoint, isn't it? It's the same thing. It's seeing something in a completely new and fresh way.
Yeah.
So when you change the way you look at something, the thing you're looking at changes.
I go even further, Esmond. From my perspective, when I talk about insight and realization, while it often comes with a new perspective, my assertion is that when you have a realization, you're getting a delivery of fresh perceptual reality. It's bringing you closer to the truth. So a lot of times people think of insight as like, oh, a good idea. But I'm talking about something even more profound. You know, the epistemologist Gregory Bateson said that the biggest problems in the world are the result of the difference between how nature already works and the way people think. Okay. Wow. And if you look at the evolution of human knowledge and human progress, it's been a process of closing the gap between how life already works and what we think. Like, we used to believe the earth was flat, and it's like, oh no, it's spherical. We used to believe that the sun went round the earth, and Galileo was like, no, the earth goes round the sun, and the church said heresy, but it was true. Boom, we're closer to reality. We used to think that infection was caused by bad smells and by moral temperament and the weather. It's like, no, it's bacteria. Mm-hmm. Like, so when I said this understanding is for psychology what the discovery of germs was to medicine, is bringing us closer to the truth of how we already work. There is a truth of your being. There's a truth of how you tick, how you work, and it's true for everyone. Someone once said to me, nothing's true for everyone. It's like, how about breathing is good? Like, that's pretty much gravity's true for everyone.
Right. Yeah. And these principles are true for everyone as well.
That's my assertion, but I don't encourage anyone to take my word for it. I say, test it out in your own experience, evaluate it in your own life, and see if what I'm pointing to is or isn't the case. Because I've been doing that for 13 years, and I haven't found an exception yet. But don't take my word for it. Honestly, don't take my word. This is an area where I deeply encourage you to do your own research. Experimentally, and find out for yourself.
Right. Thank you, Jamie.
Oh, thank you for having me, Esmond. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, it's been beautiful hearing you share. And so I know you've been working with your clarity business for many years. Are you still heading in the same direction? Are you heading in a new direction? Is there any fresh and alive with you that you can share with anyone listening about where you're headed?
Well, this is wild. So the first thing is in early 2023, we're going to be releasing the 10th anniversary edition of my first book, Clarity, which is just mind-blowing to me. It's like 10 years. And you know, when I first started out with this understanding, it was like the best-kept secret in psychology. But now, like, Clarity was a number one bestseller. Results was a Sunday Times bestseller. Hundreds of thousands of people, if not more, are now looking in this direction. So it's wonderful. So I'm, you know, people can find me in on all the usual places: Amazon, Twitter, Facebook, podcast network, all that sort of stuff. My sense is that the world is kind of at an inflection point. You know, it's kind of interesting, Esmond. The our ignorance as a species of the fact of germs and their role in creating infection was an issue for thousands of years, but it became a humanitarian crisis during the Industrial Revolution, because you had thousands and thousands of people moving into cities and going to these massive hospitals, and all of a sudden infection was out of control. And so that fulminated the need for a discovery to get closer to reality, you could say.
Interesting.
It seems to me that that was a function of the Industrial Revolution. We're going through the Information Revolution, and the massive influx of information and social media and that sort of thing is resulting in a humanitarian crisis in mental health, which is bringing the need for a deeper realization into the truth of our being. You know, psychology is a very, very new field. Freud was doing his stuff just over 100 years ago. It's a very, very new field. And there are like over 800 different schools of talk therapy and that sort of thing. And the reason is because there's no set of underlying principles that the field agrees on, right? Like if there were 100 different ideas about how physics works, we wouldn't have planes. Like we wouldn't have skyscrapers. We'd still be in huts. But because Newton, to his credit, discovered those fundamental truths of our physical world, you know, universal gravitation and the laws of thermodynamics, it created incredible increase in what's possible for us in human progress. Same with quantum theory. Quantum theory is totally out there, but it's the most experimental proven theory in all of science. Like there's more stuff being created because of quantum than any, including our phones and that sort of stuff. So it's experimentally validated. It seems to me that we're at an inflection point, as a turning point as a species, you know, we're seeing the kind of chaos and disruption and volatility and uncertainty that comes with one of those turning points. Everything from, you know, as we speak, the war in the Ukraine to the questions over elections because of social media and bots and all the different things going on. We're at a turning point. And so it seems to me that there are two things that are absolutely crucial for us as a species over the coming years. One is resilience, knowing who we are and how our experience is created is a massive contributor to resilience for anyone. So that's what we're going to need. You know, we're entering times of huge change and uncertainty. Resilience is being able to keep your bearings. That's just going to be super valuable, whatever shape that takes. I don't know what shape it's all going to take. But the other thing is wisdom. You know, one of my heroes, Barbara Marx Hubbard, when she was 17 years old, her dad was an American ambassador, and she got a chance to speak to the president at the time. This is like in the just after the First World War. And she the nuclear bombs had been dropped on, you know, Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And she got a couple of minutes with the president. She asked him, she said, "Sir, we have these incredible technological powers. For what purpose have we been given them?" And the president went silent for like a minute and said, "Young lady, I have no idea." Wow. And so she devoted her life to finding out for what purpose this technological capacity and innovation that we have, and to harnessing that and pointing that in a new direction. She's passed away now, but amazing, amazing thing.
Wow.
Anyway, it seems to me that we have technologies that would have made people 100 years ago, made their hair curl. What we need is wisdom.
Right.
We need wisdom to guide our interactions with those technologies effectively and in a way that's, you know, to the benefit of all and to the disadvantage of none. So that's my focus.
Well, I love it. And thank you for pointing all of our attention back in that direction of the source of wisdom. And peace and resilience. And I think that's really, really helpful and really valuable. And thank you for taking the time to come on today and share, as always. Really appreciate it, Jamie.
Thank you for inviting me, Esmond. It's been lovely to speak.
Pleasure, brother. Lots of love.
you lived your life like you want your life to be? Did you pass the blame, get lost on a runaway train?
The Privileged Man is a men's movement that we founded in 2021 to create safe and connected spaces for men to gather and remember how to speak the courageous language of their hearts to live more sovereign and truthful lives. Men are reclaiming the power to choose their way of being, guided by their innate wisdom in the place of societal dictates. A brotherhood of consciously connected men is forming, and we welcome you to join us. If you'd like to learn more about the brotherhood, please visit theprivilegedman.com, and we look forward to welcoming you.